Welcome to episode 2 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I am film watcher Greg Ralph.
And tonight's films we're going to be talking about, there's two Hitchcock films we're going to be talking about tonight, and also
a lighter film.
Okay, so each week we actually have a confessional, which are films which we should have really seen but haven't. Last week, my confessional was I hadn't seen Vertigo, and I was really surprised, which is Alfred Hitchcock.
Shocked, I think, would be the word.
I was very shocked that you hadn't seen Psycho.
Yeah, sorry about that.
In Psycho, Marion Crane, Janet Leigh, succumbs to temptation and flees town on a Friday night with the intention of starting again with her lover and taking $40,000 cash from her employer. As she drives towards her new life, her guilt grows. She has a change of heart and decides to return the money before the office opens on Monday. Unfortunately, she decides this while staying in an out-of-the-way motel, which has one of the most famous and fatal showers in cinematic history. The motel's owner, Anthony Perkins, has a bad case of Oedipus Rex, as is discovered by those who come looking for Marion and the missing money. A detective, Martin Balsam, Marion's lover, John Gavin, and her sister, Vera Miles. You may not check out of the Bates Motel the way you'd expect in this extremely well-known 1960 thriller. Let's talk about Psycho for a minute. What did you think, Greg?
I found it hard to really come to a landing on it. And the reason for that was that this is a film that you kind of know so much about. And there are a couple of scenes, obviously the shower scene and the scene where the detective is stabbed on the staircase, that I'd seen more than a few times. The detective scene maybe 3 or 4 times, the shower scene probably 20 or 30 times over the years. So they're meant to shock me, and they weren't, because I knew they were coming before they happened. So it's hard to really judge that. So putting that to one side, two things really struck me about it. One was how late in the film the shower scene actually comes. Mm-hmm. So the Marion Crane character, Janet Leigh, our shower girl, is actually really a whole movie about her in the first half. And that she was such a developed character really caught me off guard. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the fact that, you know, she was developing as a character. I enjoyed what I imagine was the very obvious symbolism that the first time you see her in her lingerie, it's white. Then she makes the bad decision and she's in the black lingerie. And I thought, yeah, nice touch. Yeah, I'll go with that. So I liked the story about Marion. Mm-hmm. What really surprised me and yet I really liked, and I went back and timed it, for about 15, 16 minutes of the film, either side of the shower scene, with the exception of her screams during the attack, there's no dialogue. So from the moment she says goodnight to the Anthony Perkins character, and then goes off to her room and works out where to hide the money, and he's peering through that hole in the wall.
Yeah, it's
her,
quite creepy.
And then she goes into the shower and starts the shower. Then the attacker comes in and attacks her, and you have a few screams there.
Yes, yes.
And then there's the body kind of falling over and the cleaning up of the room and putting her in the car and sinking the car in the swamp. There was no dialogue. 15, 16 minutes of a mainstream film is with no dialogue is extraordinary. And to do that back in the 60s, I think, is more extraordinary still.
It kills off the protagonist.
Yes, and I knew that, but I hadn't realised that she was so developed.
Yeah, right. No, she's very developed in that, and that's what makes it so shocking, especially when it first came out. I think people were very shocked by it. I mean, it leads you to think that a completely different film is unfolding.
I thought Janet Leigh was very good in the part, but the one I thought was terrific was Anthony Perkins.
Amazing.
So the scene at the end, or near the end, where the sister is attacked in the cellar, started off being very spooky, and then it went a bit over the top. But there were two scenes either side of that where, I don't know what he did, but whatever it was just amazing. There was when he finished the he's in the conversation with her, when she's saying, look, maybe you should leave your mother or put her in an institution. And right at the very end, when he's in the jail cell, where it's like his eyes harden. And I've got no other word for it. It's like he had whites of his eyes and suddenly he didn't, or he had light
is this
reflected
the end shot
and
the
suddenly
end
didn't
shot? Is this
the end shot the, but end also before he attacked her. It happened twice that I was really struck by.
Well, that scene is particularly chilling, and it even starts off chilling. I mean, you've got the beginning of it in the police station where you hear the mother's voice in the background say thank you, Yes. So you know something's amiss here. You don't know what's going on. And then the room itself is like, you know, just a bleak room. You know, it's like you are inside Norman's mind. His mother is his mind, you know, and you've got him wrapped in a blanket, which is very sort of cozy and like his mother's wrapped him in a blanket, you know. And then you've got the camera zoom, you know, from a wide shot to a medium close-up of Norman, you know, and this voiceover of the mother. His facial expressions sort of go with the voiceover, and then that's his end point, you know, that's when you really see him as a psycho.
Now, having said that, I thought there were two weaknesses in the film. The first one... Well, the last one, in fact, was the very last scene where you have that focus on him in the cell where he transforms into the mother.
Yes.
And then they had that last little micro shot of the car being sunk in swamp.
That's right.
And I thought, nah, what's the point of that? The other part that I got a bit impatient with was right towards the end when Simon Oakland is the psychiatrist, explaining to them all, you know, what was going on and what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, it's a bit like what you said last time about Forget Paris. I felt like I was being explained to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, I have to recognise that film was made in 1960. Here I am in 2015, so more than half a century later, when so many other books and stories and films and news stories have come out that were probably much more familiar with those kind of concepts. So I can't put myself in the shoes of someone in 1960 and look at that. But in my shoes today, I look at that and I think, no, I don't need this. And all the more wrong, because Hitchcock is the master of showing you.
Mm-hmm.
You think about that famous shot, I think right at the start of Rear Window, where the camera just tracks over a series of objects.
That's right.
And you know the story of mm-hmm. why Jimmy Stewart's in the wheelchair in the cast.
Yes, yeah.
On his leg. Very good at just coming in with the camera and showing you something and you put the pieces together.
Mm-hmm.
Simon Oakland, who I like as an actor, playing the psychiatrist in Psycho and saying, well, here's what happened and why and so on. I just thought, nah, this doesn't feel like Hitchcock.
Look, I first saw Psycho when I was a teenager. I think I was about 13 when I saw it. And it scared...
On the big screen or TV?
No, TV.
Okay, I watched it on TV.
On video. Yeah, like good old VHS. I don't know. It was even more creepy on VHS, I think, because it's, you know, it's a bit sketchier and a bit lower in quality.
Yeah.
Now it's so sharp, and the Blu-ray version's crisp as anything. I was completely spooked by Psycho. I got right into the Psychos. I mean, number 2, 3, 4, I got into all of them.
Told me that last time, and I remember while I was watching this one, thinking maybe if I knew less of the story, because I knew what happened to the main characters, at least up to the detective. After that, I had no idea where it was really going.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, maybe I should watch 2, 3, 4 to judge it. But then that's not Hitchcock. That's Richard Franklin and whoever.
But it's amazing. I mean, just as like with Hitchcock's, we're going to talk about Vertigo very soon, the music score plays such a massive part in the tension of this film. I mean, you look at the very beginning of Psycho... If you watched it without the music and you just saw, you know, Janet Leigh in her car, the music's... Dun, dun,
dun, oh, dun, dun, do you mean when she was fleeing town with money?
Yes.
Actually, my heart did start to race then.
That's right. It's all to do with the score is just phenomenal.
I felt guilty on her behalf. Yes. Yeah. So I didn't expect to spend as much time with her as I did and get as involved in her story. And even the nice way that she had the change of heart just before she got attacked... Again, if I hadn't known she was going to die, I would have expected the story to go in a different direction. And back in 1960, that would have been the case.
The thing is, what I love about Anthony Perkins in Psycho is that when I first saw it, I remember just really being so surprised because I'd never heard about, like I'd never seen or anything, known anything about Psycho. You know, I hadn't seen the images, hadn't seen the anything about it. So I was watching it for the first time. So I thought Anthony Perkins was a really nice guy. And I was really scared of his mum in the house. I remember the feeling of just being really terrified of that. So when it ended up being Anthony Perkins and then he comes out as the mother and dressed up, it was frightening for me back then, but so exhilarating at the same time.
Well, Anthony Perkins for me was a revelation
because
I've only seen him in a few bits and pieces, I think typically post-Psycho,
where
he's usually more neurotic or even a bit whingy, whiny kind of character from memory. I couldn't even tell you what films I'm thinking of, but I had that impression of him. And in this, as I said, he was a revelation. He was those two moments when he was just looked and you could feel something shift. Again, I don't know how he did it, but I just thought, wow.
In watching it now, I have rewatched it recently. I think the end scene when he does come out as the mother in the basement is a bit corny now, and it's less scary. I think it's quite a funny
thing. It's the way he kind of falls over when he's grabbed. It didn't quite work. But just before that, when she's turning the mother around,
that's right.
I actually knew it was coming, and I know there was a cut there, and I went back two or three times to look at that little sequence and thought, did they switch from a real person to the dummy? Because as she started to be turned, I thought, this is a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And then it cut to something or just changed angle slightly, whatever it was. And then you turn around to see the dummy. And when the light starts swinging, the dummy was a bit hokey at that point as well.
Yeah, it does.
But the turning around, even though I knew, was I was spooked.
Well, the dummy, I think, moves. It goes as if it's with the music. And I think it didn't sort of need the jump of the dummy.
The film really held me and stood up well.
Oh, it still does.
Even though, the shower scene for me wasn't shocking, or the stabbing of the detective. But it held up really well, and then it fell apart a little bit right in those last few scenes. So, you want to ask me what score I would give it?
What would you give it?
I'm giving it an 8. Now, I'm giving it an 8 as someone who's watching it today.
Yep.
If I watched it back then, I probably would rate it highly, highly. But also, so the ending for me was a bit weak. How about you?
I give it an 8 as well.
Oh, okay.
I agree with you.
Snap.
Yeah, I agree. Because it's close to a masterpiece, but it's in that upper echelon, but I think it's an 8.
Which is funny, because I would probably rate other Hitchcock films more highly, but it's Psycho that everyone, is the touchstone for him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's your turn now. It's another Hitchcock film, Vertigo.
Yep.
Okay, so in this 1958 film, Scotty, James Stewart, retires from the San Francisco police after a rooftop accident that leaves him with a fear of heights. But he's brought out of retirement when a friend asks him to follow his wife, Madeline, Kim Novak, who is behaving oddly and may be possessed. Scotty follows Madeline around San Francisco, which is beautifully filmed by Robert Burks, who also filmed The French Riviera in Hitchcock's To Catch a Thief, and also his stage-bound thriller, Rear Window. It seems that Madeline's husband is right. She obsesses about a woman from the past in the same way that Scotty becomes obsessed with Madeline. And he's devastated when Madeline dies from a great height. But Scotty later begins a new obsession with another woman, Judy, also played by Kim Novak, whom he seeks to remake into his lost love. This is the first film to use what's become known as the Vertigo effect, in which the camera distorts perspective so that we share Scotty's own disorientation. So, Ricardo, you know this is one of my favourites. What did you think?
A really interesting film. I'm a big fan of Rear Window and I love Hitchcock. But it had me going the whole way through.
Did you know what the twist was going to
be? I had no idea. I had no idea about Vertigo before I saw this. So every moment of the film was a surprise. I mean, the film is about obsession. In the end, I think it is a completely
obsession
about
and necrophilia.
At first, I was thinking, what is this about? Okay, sure, this guy is afraid of heights. The first scene with the running on the rooftop and, he gets Vertigo. The guy drops, falls to his death, and the husband, has this whole thing about his wife, thinks the spirits enters her body and whatnot, and she changes. I found all that really interesting, and I found that whole the Carlotta moment with the painting
of the Spanish or Mexican community.
That's right. Yeah. Those sequences and all that mystery surrounding Carlotta and the painting, and the wife going on her journeys, and James Stewart sort of looking around and following her around these amazing streets of San Francisco.
Yeah, San Francisco really comes up well in this.
It really does. I think that whole section though does go on for quite a long time. I think probably
That's a setup though.
I know. I think maybe a little bit too long though. Right. I think Hitchcock got into showing San Francisco a little bit too much in those sequences, because I think it was like an hour and a half before Kim Novak's character Madeline actually dies. And I'm going to say this is a spoiler alert.
I know. I don't think you can talk about this film without saying what happens.
That's right.
So halfway through, this woman that he becomes obsessed with dies, and he is devastated.
Devastated.
And thinks he failed to save her.
That's right.
After having already saved her once.
But then the film goes on this amazing twist here where it reveals the twist near straight after.
So I know.
Not long after, but with half an hour of the film to go, it reveals the twist completely.
So now you're actually on the sides of both Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak.
Absolutely. And so then you're going, Okay, then it reveals this mystery where he meets this other girl, what you think is another woman.
Yeah.
And we know that it is her and this twist has happened. I'm not going to give away the twist completely, just in case someone hasn't seen it.
And before you race to the end, can I just say, I read a lot of whodunits. That's one of my main leisure activities outside films. And so I'm often primed for the twist, or that there is a twist in these kind of stories. And I knew, when I first saw it, I knew pretty much from the start that the husband was setting Scotty up, the Jimmy Stewart character.
I had no idea.
No, I knew there was something wrong about the husband who was being set up, but I couldn't work out what it was. And so halfway through the film, I thought she died too. It didn't occur to me that this death was part of the twist. And then when the other woman comes back, who was the same woman, I think we have to say that, that caught me completely off guard. The scene I love, which I think is a famous scene, is the scene when he embraces her. I think by this stage we know who she really is. And the camera revolves around them. There's the green light from the hotel. The green light from the hotel shining through the windows, which gives it that greenish tinge, necrophilia kind of stuff going on in the film's theme. And the camera goes around them and it moves from the hotel room back to the Mexican convent. Yeah,
it does, that's right.
In the same room and then back to the hotel. Mm-hmm. And as visual storytelling about, you know, the stuff going on around this couple, superb.
Superb. And also those scenes, obviously, the use of colour on the faces. And the orange as well.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, there's orange. When her flashback is before the twist is revealed.
Oh, okay.
She goes orange, and then we see it from her perspective of what happened with her at the end.
But you want to talk about the end.
Okay, at the end, when they're on the tower.
Yes.
And it's being revealed. Everything's being revealed at this point. Jimmy Stewart has figured it out completely, and it's amazing because there's such a lot. There's love tension between the two. I mean, he loves her. I mean, he was being obsessed by her. He loves her. So I think he feels very betrayed by what's happened to him. But whereas she's going, yes, but I love you. Yes, I did get paid. He gave me money. But I love you. So
I didn't know you then.
And so it comes to a sort of compromise, a kiss, and then she sees a shadow, which she gets scared of and falls out the window.
Yes.
And it ends up being a nun who says, oh dear, and rings the bell, and you're left with Jimmy Stewart on the ledge, distraught, and then we fade to black.
And are you saying that's good or bad?
Well, it's an interesting way to end it. I mean, really, did that have to happen?
I think what that was about.
Did she have to die?
I think it was divine retribution.
Yeah.
It's this use of colour and style to delineate the character. So what I said a few minutes ago about Janet Leigh and the underwear goes from white to black. When she's the mysterious, loved object of affection, she's wearing that, you know, very tight grey conservative suit. With the ice blonde, you know, Hitchcock-style hair, but really kind of pinned up. Yeah. It's a very restrained character.
That's right.
And then when she becomes the real her, and she's all kind of the long, flowing hair, almost the gypsy kind of look, and the darker hair, you know, the brunette hair and so on, there's a much more almost free-flowing sexuality about her.
There is.
And then he has to put her back into that former mould. He has to recreate her back to what he fell in love with her.
That's right.
And when the reality of who she really is becomes true, becomes revealed, she dies by being scared by the church and then the bell rung out for her soul. I mean, there's not a message there. They couldn't really kiss and walk off into the sunset.
No, they really couldn't. I mean, it does become a full circle when she does. I mean, in his obsession, he's tried to change her into this other woman. So it makes a lot of sense that she dies that way.
The only other way I think you could end it, and I don't necessarily like this.
But what was the shadow? Was she seeing in demons? Was she thinking it was...
I think it was maybe the shadow of the woman who died, the wife, who I don't think we ever actually met. You know, the real wife.
Yes. No, yeah, we didn't.
But the only other way I could think you could end it is that if things were set up where her life was imperiled by the husband, and if Scotty rescued her and the husband died and fell, that would be an ending that would be okay. But I think the ending we have is actually more powerful. A bit heavy on the symbolism. It kind of works. And I love that scene beforehand with the expanding staircase.
Oh, amazing. I mean, the way Hitchcock shoots those sequences to really get a sense of his vertigo are amazing uses of the camera.
And I'm not at all good with heights. And I just so get that shot.
It makes you really understand where he's coming from and what he's going through.
Exactly.
One scene which I thought was quite clunky, though, it's the second scene.
Which is
he's in the apartment with
his friend Mitch.
But it's just an exposition scene. There's a lot of clunky dialogue where she's saying, you know, oh, you're a detective. Now you're going to give up this thing. It sets things up. And he's also, he's quite buoyant after that. He's quite sort of in a jovial sort of mood at the very beginning of that scene. And I was thinking, is this the past? Have we gone back, or is this after this? You know, it was a little bit weird.
That's funny, because the one scene I don't like in it is, I think, a bit later, but it's with the Midge character again, where she tries to confront him about his obsession, and he reacts badly and leaves, and she's there going, oh, Midge, you mucked that up, or whatever she says, and it didn't quite work.
Is that the scene where she pulls her hair and says, you're stupid? Yes. I found that really bizarre, that scene. I find the whole Midge character.
The Midge.
What was her purpose in the film?
She's got two purposes. One
just
is
a sounding board, really.
Well, one is exposition, what you're saying, a sounding board, to comment to him and to draw out stuff from him away from the situation.
Mm.
And the other, I think, is to be the alternative woman. She's in opposition to the Kim Novak character, whatever her name is.
Yes.
Madeline. So Midge is in opposition to Madeline. Even the name. Madeline's a very voluptuous name. Midge is kind of almost swallowed. Although she's a career woman. I think she's an artist or something.
She's an artist, yeah.
She's a career woman.
She's in designs or something, brassieres or...
In fact, everything about her is in direct opposition to Madeline. The name, the style, restrained versus designing bras.
True.
The modern woman and the woman lost in the mists of time as Carlotta and so on. Mm. I think her function is to be in opposition, but... I get it, but there's something about Midge that just doesn't quite work. And for me, that's the weak point in the film.
No, I think I agree completely. In terms of his dream sequences and his nightmares, though, as well, beautifully done.
Although you'd have to go far to beat the one in Spellbound, the Salvador Dali dream sequence.
I haven't seen that.
You haven't seen Spellbound?
No.
There's a future confession coming up.
You know, it's quite interesting that Vertigo has been... put on a pedestal of the best film of all time.
Well, it knocked Citizen Kane off about five, eight years ago or something?
Yeah, oh, I should listen to that, I think. Which is really interesting, because I thought, it's not my favourite Hitchcock. And I think, you know, Citizen Kane deserves the top spot.
You know, there's that scene in Vertigo where he's recreating the second woman as Madeline, and he takes her to the dress shop, and he's very specific about the suit.
Yes.
And the saleswoman makes that comment, "Sir knows what he wants, doesn't he?" There's a French film I saw some years ago, no idea what it's called, but it had a similar kind of thing going on, and he does the same thing, takes her to a dress shop to outfit her in a certain way, and the sales lady says there, you know, but in French, says, Monsieur certainly knows what he wants. You know, it is that kind of reference point.
Yeah, right.
So, you've now finally seen Vertigo.
I have.
Your score?
Oh, I'm going to give it a 9.
It's a 9 for me too. It's very close there. I think it's a great film, and it's certainly one of the greats.
It is, yeah.
Midge just takes it down a notch for me, so I'm giving it a 9.
Yeah, I agree. 9.
Yeah. Snap.
Okay, so the film we're going to talk about this week and review, really, is a romance comedy drama.
Mm. Mm.
It's Love Actually. It's a favourite.
It's a favourite. I don't think I've met anyone who hasn't at least liked, if not indeed loved, this film.
Mm.
And I was talking about it in the last day or so with people at work who I know a bit, but never talked about this film before. And again, some people hadn't seen it, which surprised me, but a couple of people were saying, I love this film, and I totally get that. I could literally talk about this film for an hour. I won't, but I absolutely could. I sat down to watch it again last night, not having seen it for maybe 3 or 4 films, and it caught me by surprise. I sat down, and the opening scene is all the greetings at the airport at Heathrow.
Oh, it's a beautiful scene.
And the voice of Hugh Grant, who you later discover is the Prime Minister, is saying about how love is always there. And, of course, that's the main theme of the film. And the film really looks at different sorts of love, and I'll come back to that, I think. But in there, what I'd forgotten was he makes this statement in that first little monologue. And let me place this film. It came out in 2003. So it was being made in the shadow of the World Trade Center 9/11, 2001.
Yeah.
And I did a bit of reading about this overnight because I was so engaged by the film again. And Laura Linney talks about the fact that the last scene they filmed was the wedding in the chapel. Not the last, one of the last scenes they filmed was this wedding in the chapel. And that particular chapel is down the road from the American Embassy in London. And the crew had a minute's silence for 9/11 during this day's filming. So they were very much aware of the fact that they're filming in this time when something very bad, traumatic, seismic shift event had happened. And in this opening monologue, Hugh Grant, the Prime Minister, talks about the fact that when the planes went into the buildings at World Trade Center in 2001, no one, as far as I know, he says, rang to, you know, be negative to someone. They were all farewell messages of love. And I started crying. I was prepared to get emotional at the film, but in these opening scenes where he says that, and meanwhile you're seeing all these real people, I discovered, it was all filmed at Heathrow Airport. There weren't actors who were doing all these greetings, and every time they filmed something which they thought they might use, they ran out and got people to sign releases for it. It was real people doing this. And it just grabbed me.
Mm.
And at the end of the film, when they do that again, and you're seeing all this all over again after being through all these different stories, and look, I'm a wuss about these kind of films, I really am, but I was sobbing. My chest was heaving.
Yeah.
Because I was so caught up in this really glorious celebration of love and what it is in the human story.
Yeah.
And coming back to the idea,
it's a lovely way to connect it all and what they're talking about. With that opening scene, every time I think, am I going to watch Love Actually tonight? If I put that movie on, after that opening scene, there's no doubt I'm watching Love Actually.
It's such an affirmation. That's what I'm saying. Historically now, even though they're aware of the time, I think we can really put it as an affirmation of something glorious in a time of bleakness.
That's a really interesting perspective.
And one of the things I really love about this film is that it's looks at all these different forms of love. Now, again, it's interesting when you, and this is one of the probably the very few films where I say to people, you must watch the deleted scenes. So Richard Curtis, if you have access to the DVD or whatever, Richard Curtis talks about the fact that the first cut of the film was 3.5 hours long.
Richard Curtis did direct the film.
And wrote it, yes. It was the first one he directed. Certainly not the first he'd written. And the first cut was 3.5 hours long. They got it down to 2 hours and 8 minutes. They cut out a lot of stories.
Mm.
They both took a scene out of pretty much every story to compress them, and they dropped other storylines. And there are other storylines that I really regret were taken out of the film that you see there. And reading around it also, you find out that there were these other types of love that were talked about. So in the real film, you know, the official film, you have a lot of different forms of love. You've got parent-child or step-parent, step-child for that matter. You've got long-term marriage. You've got
brother-sister.
You've got the first love in the boy and the girl he has a crush on.
Mm-hmm.
You have the unrequited love of the guy who worships Juliet, and you couldn't get a more, you know, love-soaked name than Juliet.
Yeah.
You've got the story of the love between the rock star and his manager.
Yes.
That he finally acknowledges.
Yes. Yeah.
You have the crush for 2 years of Laura Linney and the guy she fancies at work.
Yeah.
That's in opposition with the familiar love of her brother, who's obviously has some kind of mental health condition.
That's right.
That really absorbs her and, in fact, in the end, thwarts this other love she could have.
Mm.
All these different loves. The one that is obviously missing from the story is love between people of the same sex.
Yeah,
the closer you get to it, and you're kind of left wondering for a bit about the rock star and his manager, and I think it becomes quite clear towards the end of the film, no, that's not what it's about.
I think it's more of a friendship love.
It is.
From a long-term friendship love.
Yes, it's amity.
Yes.
Whereas there is a story about the love between two long-term partners, two women, which were dropped, which is a lovely little vignette. And two great British actresses. You've got Anne Reid and you've got Frances de la Tour. And not only a story of lesbian love, but in the story, Frances de la Tour is dying and, in fact, dies of cancer. So this real love in a time of...
And they filmed that, did they?
They filmed it. This is in the extra scenes.
Wow.
It's a lovely little story. And it got dropped with another story, which, again, I really regret never made it into the film, between Emma Thompson and the son. So you get a little bit in the film about, you know, her son's difficult and so on. But in the the drop sequence, Emma Thompson gets brought into the headmistress's office, played by Anne Reed, who in that scene is all, oh, we've brought you in here because your son did something inappropriate in an essay assignment. And the assignment was, you know, my Christmas wish. And the headmistress and her teacher talk about, you know, all these wonderful, uplifting things that other kids wrote about. And the son wrote about, wouldn't it be great if you could see farts? And then Emma Thompson is made to read out this essay while you see the Queen farting and Grandma farting and the choir and the church farting and so on. It's very whimsical, and yeah, that's great in its own right. But then there's this beautiful, beautiful moment that should have been in the film where she takes him outside the headmistress's office, you know, to talk to her son, where she apologises to the son that we put you in this school where no one appreciates your wit and your comedy gold and your insight. And, you know, this is a great story. And it's a real shift between the mother who doesn't really get her son and finds him difficult and the boy playing the son, you know, where all his scenes were cut from the film, just lights up. And then later you follow the headmistress home to where she visits her dying partner and she tells her about this meeting. And the partner says, oh, as I read the essay, it was very funny. And the headmistress says, yes, I know, but I couldn't say that. So there's that story of a different sort of love, or two different sorts of love, you know, the headmistress and her partner, the mother and her son that never made it in. In the reading I was doing overnight, there's a story about two schoolgirls who fall in love. So in some ways, there was a whittling away, not the mother-son bit, a whittling away of maybe less mainstream kind of love stories. But even so, it's just wonderful in how it just takes different sorts of love. Colin Firth, whose wife cheats on him and he's shattered by, goes and finds love with someone he can't even speak to. You know, the Portuguese cleaner, I think she is.
That's right.
And it's all kind of thrown in and jumbled together, and a lot of the characters know each other, or you find out they're next-door neighbours or whatever. So it's kind of that jumble of the world we live in, and love shines through.
It's that multi-narrative structure, which I think is... I mean, they've really tried to replicate Love Actually through a few other American films like Valentine's Day and New Year's Eve, I think.
Yes, but Richard Curtis himself says that he realised when he was writing the story, he realised that so many of his favourite films were these multi-narrative stories that he wanted to do. So he himself recognises that he's within a tradition. Or Nashville. He says that Nashville is his favourite film.
Robert Altman again.
Exactly, exactly.
I agree with what you're saying about Love Actually, and I really love the film as well. There's parts of the film, I remember when I first watched it, which really irked me, though, and performances which really irked
me. Is this going to include the dance scene?
Well, not just the dance scene. I just really didn't believe Hugh Grant as the Prime Minister.
Oh, I did. I knew it was whimsy, but I did.
No, I didn't at all. There's a scene in it which still makes me cringe. I think in repeat viewings, I like him a lot more in the film as the Prime Minister. But the one scene which makes me cringe every time is the scene with Billy Bob Thornton as the US President coming in to visit, and he stands up for the country. I just do not believe him whatsoever.
No, I know. And you know who was Prime Minister at that time? It was Tony Blair. You know what he said about the film? Tony Blair was put into a bind a year or two later where he was being encouraged to react against something the Americans were doing. And he said, look, I know everyone would like me to be Hugh Grant from Love Actually, but the thing about a film is you don't have to live with the day after, the week after, the year after.
Interesting.
But look, I agree. I'm not a big Billy Bob Thornton fan. I don't even know really what I've seen him in. I just found him a little bit too smooth and uptight or closed to be believable.
Billy Bob Thornton?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting, because I didn't even think of Billy Bob Thornton. I thought he was just the US president. It was more Hugh Grant in that scene trying to show the strength. Just didn't work. I mean, I love Hugh Grant. I think he's wonderful.
But it's there as a crowd cheering moment, which is what Blair was saying, basically. It's interesting. I was doing a bit of reading overnight. Hugh Grant struggled with this part. He'd done a lot of work for Richard Curtis. Richard Curtis made him a star through Four Weddings and a Funeral, for example, when he wrote that. And Hugh Grant apparently wanted to keep that part much more grounded, didn't like the whimsy. And in fact, the last scene that they filmed was the dance scene. Now, when I first saw it, that dance scene stood out for me, not in a good way. I liked it. I liked the idea of the Prime Minister dancing around number 10 and so on. But at the same time, I felt like this is put in here to manipulate me in a way mm-hmm. I didn't feel with the rest of the film. And yet I still love the scene. And I love it when he dances, you know, across the corridor.
I think in repeat viewings, I sort of let it go. And I enjoy him in the film. But on my first viewing, it just annoyed me. I laugh at that dance sequence now, and it's fine. The other story, now there's quite a few stories in this. You've got Liam Neeson, you've got Colin Firth, you've got Alan Rickman, you've got Laura Linney. But the one which really gets is the guy that goes to the US.
Oh, okay. Chris Marshall, I think it is.
Yeah, Chris Marshall's character. And he goes to the US and picks up these three American women in a bar.
The first time he walks into one.
The first time he walks into one in the US in this car. I just find that whole, it's just a fantasy.
And it's Hugh Grant as the Prime Minister.
Well, it is fantasy, but to an extent. I mean, look, he's falling in love with somebody who is his assistant in there, so I believe that relationship. But this guy walking into a bar, and suddenly there's three models sitting at a bar, and he's going to have a foursome with these three models in a bar just because he's got a British accent.
Who all seem remarkably innocent.
Yeah, I just...
That completely frustrated me,
because that's not love.
Well...
Really?
Yeah. Well, no, I know. But I guess what
it's like a lust. Well,
what I'm saying is there's different dimensions of love, and who knows what springs from that. And so much love starts with lust anyway. But in this film, because there's all these multi-narratives going on, you could take one out and it would work. But if you took any of those narratives out of it, it would be a lesser film except for the Chris Marshall story. I agree. You could quite happily lose that. No reflection on the actor. But you can quite happily lose that, and the film... In fact, I would rather see that lost and the headmistress and the son brought in.
Yeah, right, okay.
And as I say, really want to advocate anyone listening, watch the deleted scenes. You've got to hunt a bit to find them, but mm-hmm. it really pays off. And we have not yet touched on Bill Nye. This is the first film I think he ever made, certainly the first one I saw him in.
Well,
And he just strode in and owned it.
Oh, he's amazing in this, and his whole story. I mean, his whole story is the binding element of the whole multi-narrative structure.
And he's outside all the other stories.
He really is. He's the outsider. He's a musician in the film who comes up with it because it's set around Christmas in the theme of love. It's set at Christmas, and he comes out with this song, this really cheesy Christmas song. And so it's a really clever device because it's used throughout the film to bind the stories together. And so, you know, if you've got another story, it can cut to a television and you've got Bill Nighy on it in the music video. And then it can go to another scene. It's the glue of the stories. So it's a clever device. And he's amazing. He's fantastic in the role.
It's also a very different love to the others. It's the only one that really is, I think, about friendship.
Yeah.
Rather than romantic or sexual love.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting how that one kind of stands outside all the others.
Mm.
Although that theory would fall apart if you had the story about Emma Thompson and her son, which is, you know, another kind of love as well.
Mm.
We haven't yet talked about Rowan Atkinson.
Oh, wow. Okay, yes, Rowan Atkinson. I completely forgot about Rowan Atkinson.
Well, he's only in two scenes.
He is. He's like the angel, isn't he?
Well, he in fact was an angel in an earlier draft of the script. And in fact, they shot a scene where he dematerialised in Heathrow Airport. And I only read that.
Oh, wow.
I only read that last night after, again, watching the film. And it was really interesting because the two times, he's only in it twice, the two times he's in the film, he is aiding a situation. So the really obvious one is when he's at the airport gate and the son wants to go through and catch up with the girl.
That's right.
And he is giving his hat and his gloves and whatever to the security guard. And the boy slips through and then he kind of takes it back and says, oh, I must have left it somewhere else. And he turns around and he gives a knowing smile to Liam Neeson. But once you know that he's meant to be this, or was originally intended to be this angelic interventionist... And go back and think about the other scene where he's wrapping the parcel for Alan Rickman.
Yes,
and
yes.
And he's slowing him right down. He's putting in the cinnamon sticks and all the blossoms.
Yeah,
and
that's a great scene.
And the first time I saw it, I just thought, this is, you know, bureaucracy, basically. But when you look at it from this other angle, what he's actually doing is he's actually making this purchase impossible for Alan Rickman before the wife gets back.
That's right.
So he's actually giving him a second chance at salvation of his marriage.
Yep.
And then Rickman goes away and does it anyway, as we know. And there's that wonderful, awful scene where Emma Thompson finds out and is shattered up in her room. Rod Atkinson.
That's Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson story, yes. When he's having the affair and she finds out is so heartbreaking.
Yes.
For Emma Thompson.
Beautifully performed too. I misremembered that story. I thought that she ended up leaving him, but in fact she stays. But the ground has shifted.
Absolutely.
They're in that situation where they're staying together for the kids almost and keeping that all running, but the love is gone now.
All that has to be worked on.
So, scores.
Oh, firstly, I want to have one more thing, is Martin Freeman.
Yes, before he was famous.
Before he was famous. It was after The Office.
Was it?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
And I think it's wonderful. It's a really short part of the film. It's only in certain aspects of the film it's in. He's a porn body double. And he meets this girl.
Who's a porn body double.
And they fall in love being stand-ins for porn actors. It's a cute little relationship in there which builds. And really beautifully shot too.
I'm not sure it's actually a porn film because the sets are pretty marvelous.
No, I think there's sex scenes. I think there's just sex scenes and nude sex scenes. It's only 4 minutes, that whole story.
And yet it feels real.
I broke this film down in trying to study the multi-narrative structure on here.
Oh, that sounds right.
And I cut this film into all short films and all the stories into short films, which was a really interesting watch.
And when they go out on their date, they can't quite kiss each other. You know, it's quite sweet.
It's very sweet, yeah. And then at the very end, they're engaged. And
yes. So scores. For you?
I give it a 7.
A 7? That's a hard mark. Why is it only a 7?
I think it's great. That's an enjoyable mark. That's an enjoyable film, a 7. I mean, it's nowhere near an 8 to 10 classic for me. I think it's a really enjoyable film. I pull it out every now and then and watch it. It's a 7.
It's a 9 for me.
9.
And I would give it a 10 if I could see the 3.5 hour version. For me, it's right up there because it achieves exactly what it sets out to do. It engages people. It will become a classic in the same way I think that Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, for example, does.
Well, that's a big statement.
It is a big statement. I think it's well on the way to becoming a well-loved and, as you just said yourself, watched and rewatched and rewatched film. Maybe on your own, but certainly in groups or families and at Christmas. I think it's really going to be there.
Okay, now it's time for our confession for which movies that we haven't seen sacrilegiously.
Okay, so the one I've got for you, which I'm pretty sure you haven't seen, is Charade. So this is early 1960s.
I haven't seen Charade.
Good. Cary Grant, Audrey Hepburn. Both in their prime, a nice, light kind of... It's a caper movie, basically.
Stanley Donen film.
It is. Music by Henry Mancini.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to you about it next time, but I'm curious to know how you find it.
So moving on to your confession.
Yes.
For this film, you really should have seen as a film lover and film watcher.
The Bicycle Thieves, post-war Italy...
Directed by Vittorio De Sica.
See, this is going to be the problem next time. You'll just rattle off these Italian names and I'll be going, Victor somebody. And I'm really hoping you'll let me watch this with subtitles on, right?
Of course. Okay, so that's it for our episode 2 podcast and we'll be back next time.
Next time. We hope you enjoyed that and that we didn't go on too long about Love Actually, but I just love it.
See you next time.